No, I don't think there is. So I'm going to introduce the second of tonight's speaker. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Tony.
Thanks, Gary.
I'm Tony. I'm an addict.
Hey, Tony.
I'm really tired today. It's like, and when I'm tired, it can go, I give you my all or I give you nothing. So I'm not sure what you're going to get. I didn't get until 7:30 this morning from work. I'm a DJ and I like did 3 gigs last night. It just completely, it annihilates me because I'm one of these people that can't sleep during the day because to me it reminds me of old behaviours. It's like, you know, going to bed when it's dark and waking up when it's dark is not a good thing for me. So I tend to sort of like have an hour's kip in the morning and then I'm vile all day. Absolutely hideous to everybody that comes in my way. You know, everyone stays out. We have this a Monday factor and a Friday factor in our flat. So, you know, stay well clear and try and not have a conversation with me. So thanks, Gary, for today. You know, it's kind of weird. Gary just said to me, if you haven't hit rock bottom by 8:15, liven it up. Yeah, so I'm going to go straight in. Right, for me, you know, to do this is, you know, I'm a DJ and I can quite easily stand in front of thousands and thousands of people and do what I do without nerves. But to come here and actually give you the real Tony and without masks, because it's really easy for me to put on a mask and to cover up the fact of vulnerability. And I don't like feeling vulnerable in any shape, way or form, because, you know, it kind of, it's a bit too real for me, because I kind of like to live a little bit of fantasy, you know, within my life, and everything's okay, when it's really and it's not, you know. So you're like, are they going to get Rod Hole today or are you going to get Emu? And, you know, because that's what it's like, you know. All day today I've had this, I don't have a little voice in my head saying, don't do this, don't do this. I have a fucking great big voice that rows with me constantly. And it's almost to the extent of bipolar. You know, I row with myself. If I'm no one else to row with, I'll have a row with a dog. Or, you know, I'll have a row. And, you know, my head all day today is like, you know, why did you say yes? You know, and it's true, you know, for me, I'm a firm believer that if it's not uncomfortable, it's not service. You know, it has to be uncomfortable to make it real service. Because, you know, you going out of your way and it's painful, that's service. You know, and that's a job well done for me. I truly believe that, you know. I came to this fellowship just under 8 years ago. I'll be 8 years in January. And for somebody like me that, you know, I 28 years every day of using drugs and abusing drugs and using people and abusing people. That was my life, you know. As a kid, you know, I come from a really alcoholic family. My dad was an alcoholic, all of his sisters and all his brothers, his dad. It was just every generation in our family were alcoholics. And, you know, growing up in that environment, you know, my other brothers were always in trouble with the police. I've told this story before, so if you've heard it, please, you know, just roll with it, you know. You know, my brothers were always in trouble with the police, and, you know, I was the middle gay one, you know, and it's kind of like I had to scream to be heard, you know. And the only attention that we got in our house was negative attention, you know, because my brothers were always getting this attention, like the police knocking on the door. Everything would be about them. And little old me always sitting in the corner playing, you know, by myself, and, you know, never got the attention that I seek. So, you know, being surrounded around negative attention, you seek negative attention. You know, I would throw myself downstairs. I would take loads of tablets. I would fall off my skateboard and you know, end up in hospital for 3 days, nothing wrong with me. I was on crutches for a year and a half, walking around pretending, and I made up the story that I'd trodden on a Coca-Cola bottle with a bit of glasswood in my foot and it must have had dog piss on it. And, just, you know, you make up these fucking stories and you elaborate on them and they become so big, and suddenly I'm on crutches for a year and a half, you know. And that was the reality of it. And, you know, the extension of that, I had to have my foot, I had an operation on my foot, and I had 21 stitches all the way along the way foot so that they could get the scar tissue out, and there was no scar tissue, you know. But I went with it because I was getting the attention. I was getting that attention that I so wanted and so craved. And, you know, when you're that vulnerable and you put yourself in that position where you seek that attention, there's people in this world that will give you that attention, the wrong type of people. And, you know, at the age of 9, I was sexually abused, which, you know, a lot of people see it as like, you know, oh God, it was the worst time of my life. But for me, it was enlightening. It was suddenly I was getting everything I ever wanted from anybody. You know, I had all the attention. I could control somebody. It changed the way I felt. It made me feel important. It gave me a voice. And that went on for years, you know. My mum had cancer at that point, and my dad was drinking. And my dad would beat my mum up. And, you know, I had this way and a means of getting out of that. I could get money. You know, I had a tool, quite literally had a tool that I could use against somebody and get what I wanted. And it changed everything. And, you know, from there, you know, I started drinking. Alcohol came into play. That changed the way I felt. I became fat. So it was like, you know, I got into food. You know, looking back on it, you know, I wasn't fat for a reason. I got into food. And, you know, you know, that was my way of saying, don't come near me. Fuck off. This is my defence. You know, apart from my mouth, that was the other defence. You know, that was the one that always got me in trouble. And kind of, that was it. And, you know, I could... It was, you know, as things pan out, you know, the when something's so negative, it's so hard to turn that negativity into positivity, especially at a young age. So, you know, it comes out sideways, and that's such an analogy I hate using, because it's like, it just reminds me of rehab, and it reminds me of you lot, and it reminds me of, you know, oh, we're coming out sideways. It's just like, but you know what? For me at that point in time, you know, I was a demon. I was just like unruly. I didn't go to school. I would go cottaging, which is like hanging around public toilets, you know, at the age of 14. I would have sex with 8 to 10 blokes a day. That was my normal day, and then I'd go home and pretend I'd been at school and everything was okay. And that was my life. You know, and of course, you know, all of those things lead to one thing, and I, you know, in the end I was thrown out of school at 14 for having sex with my drama teacher, you know. Having sex in the classroom, I fell through a window at lunch break with my trousers around my ankles. And my mum and dad were called up to school. We had these windows, they were like 12 foot by like 12 foot, massive square windows, and it was frosty. And I was like leaning against it, doing whatever I was doing, and I went through the window, and the window smashed. And called up in front of the headmaster, you know, they pulled my mum in, and they didn't mention the fact that I was having sex. He broke a window. And I was like, wow, yeah, I broke a window, yeah. You know, and I was like suspended. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I had to leave the room. And it's like my mum came out. It's like, I can't believe you've done this. They wouldn't discuss what I did in front of me. And it was kind of like, it was always that way through life at that point. And, you know, so yeah, got suspended from school and kicked out, you know, and of course, we couldn't tell my dad. We could not tell my dad would have battered me. My dad would have battered my mum. My dad, you know, let alone the whole gay side of it. You know, he knew what I was, but, you know, he didn't want it shoved in his face every day. Because my dad was like 6'6", you know, hands like bananas, like his fingers were like massive. And when we did stuff, and we'd lock ourselves in our bedroom, he'd punch a hole through the bedroom wall to get you, you know, literally through the bedroom wall. And it'd be like, you know, we run for our lives, you know. And so I would leave the house every day in school uniform and get round the corner and take it all off with my jeans underneath it, and I'll put it in my bag, and off I'd go down the King's Road. And I got a job working in the King's Road, and, you know, slowly but surely got into going out clubbing, and, you know, and alcohol took over. Alcohol took over from food. Alcohol took over from everything, apart from sex. Sex was always there. And, you know, slowly but surely, by the age of 16, I was so far in going into clubbing. I was out every night. You know, the natural progression of, you know, drugs in those days was poppers. Everyone was doing, like, poppers or ethyl chloride, which was, like, you know, you get a glass flask and you put it on a hanky and you stick it in your mouth and you'd flow. It was like, you know, it's ether. So you'd be like, yeah, you know. This is at 16, and, you know, it was always those drugs, and but I never smoked. I don't smoke. It's disgusting, you know. Yeah. And slowly but surely, one night someone said to me, oh, do you want a line of coke? And I said, oh, it's not really me. It's not really my thing. I don't need it. Because, you know, I was like a really, you know, I am a really loud, in-your-face, up-in-your-grill pipe type of person. And at that time, at 16, I was a lot worse. I was fat and I was on a mission. If I couldn't sleep with you, I hated you. That was the way it was, you know. And I would destroy. I would destroy anything my way. You know, when you're in that place, you can manipulate and you can transform anything to visionary. You could. I had this ability, or so it seemed, that I could make whatever I wanted happen. You know, it was like, you know, I didn't think I had superpowers or anything like that, but what I did know was that it's just like, if I wanted something, I got it. You know, whether it be good or bad. You know, and when I did get it, it wasn't always the thing that I wanted. You know, I learned that through time, and I learned that by getting my fingers burnt so many times. And, I kind of like... So cocaine. I hated it. Absolutely hated it. Hated the taste, hated the feeling, hated the way it went down the back of my throat. So, of course, next day did it again, and again and again. And, you know, before I knew it, I had a problem. But I was 18. You know, I was 18. And, my career and my life was just starting in that sense. And I had this world, and I was introduced, and you know, to so many different things, and the quality of friends and the quantity of friends that I had increased. I was travelling the world. I was doing what I never ever wanted to be a DJ. I didn't have a dream. I never ever had any ambition whatsoever. I had that beaten out of me at the age of 9. You know, I had no self-worth. So, therefore, I didn't have a goal. I didn't have a vision of where I wanted to be in 10 years' time. I didn't have a vision of where I was going to be in 10 years' time. I didn't know where I was going to be in fucking 10 minutes' time. But you know what? It was where it was at. And, you know, it was kind of like I was... In my head, I was living the dream. I was flying around the world. I was doing everything that was possible given to me. You know, I would get gigs all over. And... you know, DJing was a way and a means for me to get more. Like, you know, it really was. You know, the more money I earned, the more money I spent. The more money I earned, the more out of it I was. It wasn't a glamorous life, by far. You know, the first couple of years were really amazing. I've got to give that. You know, but as the drugs took over, everything else kind of drifted away. You know, I'd get flown to New York and... I'd play in New York every 2 weeks, and I was getting flown on Concorde, and you know, twice I went and flown on Concorde to play it for this guy called Steve Rebello, who used to do Studio 54, and then he opened all these massive clubs in New York. And I kind of, for a while, you know, I was Miss Thing. You know, it was like, yeah! And I'd arrive, and we just discovered E in those days. He had just come into play in America and in New York, and we'd get it in little grand bottles, and we'd do the 5 dots. And you know, and if you didn't have the shutter vision by within 10 minutes, you'd do another 5 bumps, you know. And you know, it was like that whole, and you'd wake, you know, you'd come round lying on top of the fag machine in the corridor, you know? And it's like, yeah, and you know, and it was the most amazing high. It would change yet again, another thing that changed everything, you know. And I would get flown over, I'd get met at the airport, I'd get given what I needed to be given, and I'd go to the club, and, you know, on so many occasions, I never even got to the club. But yet, these crazy Americans loved the fact that I never got to the club. Oh, you're amazing, yeah. Yeah. I remember one time at the Palladium in New York, and I like literally got off the plane, and they drove me to the airport, to the club, and I was like, I'd done a grand bottle on my hand, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, it's not working, give me more. And this guy gave me another bottle, and I was like, I literally bent down to get a record, and I came back up, I was like, I fell against the wall. And there was no wall, because I was actually on a 12-foot high stage, and I went backwards and was unconscious on the floor. I came round and left the club. And the next day he's going, wow, man, what a great set list. And I was like, is this serious? And all my friends like, you played one record. I was like, okay, that's kind of good for me. It's getting there, you know what I mean? It's getting a little bit better. And that, you know, that was the way it was. That was the way it was. And, you know, when people give you that stuff and encourage you that stuff, you just want more, and you take it to another level. And, you know, it went, my career, you know, went like that and then went like that. But, you know, it never went to the point of, oh, shit, my career's over. I always maintained, you know, I'd created a monster out of what I was. You know, people expected me not to sleep 3 days before I did a gig. People knew that I was a car crash. I would turn the records off and say, no K, no play. Bring me ketamine over the microphone in clubs. And people would bring it, and I would give me it, and then I'd say, okay, we start again. And, you know, that was if I turned up. That was if I turned up. And, you know, of course, in those days, you know, we were at all these new after-hour clubs that had just opened in London, and we'd gone through Acid House, and, you know, it'd all gone back to the gay side of things, you know. The straights had ruined it again, by the way, with the Acid House. You know, and let me just put it out there. You ruined it. And then we brought it back, and we kind of, like, it all come back to home, and, you know, and we were doing these amazing hedonistic all-night clubs, which, you know, London had never seen before, because you were, you know, we had a 3 o'clock, if you were lucky, came into play, and then it would be six. And we had clubs like Trade, and we had all these new things opening. It was all exciting, and, you know, and playing at that type of thing was, it went with the job. Being what I was went with the job. Being that junky mess went with the job, because by this time, I'd so far gone, you know, I'd stopped travelling. I didn't travel anymore because, you know, my life had gone all out of control. So no one trusted me to fly. I would go to the airport with my partner and say, you know what, let's not get this flight. Let's just go back to the dealer's house. And off we'd go back to the dealer's. You know, I would think, I went to Hong Kong last year and there was no coke. I'm not going there today. And I would blow it out on the day. And, you know, that it doesn't take long for that stuff to get around. You know what I mean? That you're unreliable, you know. And I stopped travelling. But that was my choice, that I stopped travelling. No one else's. You know what I mean? I decided that. It had nothing to do with the fact that I didn't turn up. You know, it was my decision. It was always my decision. I was always in charge. And so it seemed. And, you know, it got to the stage where I would lock myself in rooms. I didn't look at a dance floor. I didn't look at a crowd for 4 years. This is at the end of that 28 years, you know. I sat rocking backwards and forwards psychotically. I pulled all my own teeth out with a screwdriver and bits of stick and anything I could get my hands on. I tugged at my teeth. I had so many gum infections. I kept passing out and thinking that it was down to the amount of temazepam, Rohypnol. You know, I was a firm believer in roller coasting. You know, whatever, every high I took a low. You know, my jaw, it took me, you know, I'm 8 years sober now and clean. And, you know, it's taken me 6 of those years to stop gurning. And I still gurn now when I DJ. And people still think that I'm out of my fucking nut, which is really annoying. You know, but it's just like, and I had to go and see a specialist to teach me how to stop gurning by changing the neuropaths in my brain. And it sounds like, oh, yeah, right. But, you know, it had to be done. Because, you know, constantly I still do it. And when I'm tired, it comes into play. And I forget the tools that I've been taught. Just like this fellowship and this programme, I forget those tools so easily. You know, anyway, kind of long story short, I kept passing out my, you know, my partner at the time that I was with would turn up in clubs that I was at and say, start fights, always him starting the trouble. All he was doing was saying to go into clubs and saying, do you want to find him dead on your toilet floor? What are you doing employing him? Do you want to find him dead. That's what's going to happen. And I'd say, get him out, he's mental. And, you know, he's just trying to ruin our buzz. Get him out of here. And, you know, and I'd hide from him. I'd see him coming and we'd all hide. And we'd like, you know, oh, my God, he's coming to ruin it. You know, bearing in mind I'd gone out of house on Thursday and it was now Sunday afternoon and I, you know, had no intentions of going home until Tuesday. You know, and, yeah, it was dark times. And, you know, throughout that time, you know, I cheated on him every day of that relationship. And, you know, it kind of breaks my heart because he's sitting in this room. And, you know, it's kind of hard to talk about that stuff because, you know, before I could talk about it so easily and laugh about it and think about, yeah, I'm the man. But you know what? I'm not. Without this fellowship and this program, I'm a lying, cheating skank. And, you know, this fellowship is what keeps me alive, and this is what fellowship has given me my self-respect back. It's changed everything. It's changed the way I feel. And far greater than any drug or drink or anything else that I put into my body, quite literally, it's changed the way I feel. And, you know, I came to this fellowship 8 years ago. Someone said to me, oh, you know, I was in the club, rocking backwards and forwards, bright orange with one tooth. looked amazing. Literally, I'd, you know, as long as I had, you know, a pair of decent trainers on my feet, I looked amazing. Or I, you know, I'd borrowed someone else's jumper or whatever. You know, I thought I looked amazing. Because, you know, my life at that point, everything was measured in drugs. Everything I had, everything I owned. I'd been thrown out. I'd lost my house over in Pimlico. By this time, I'd, you know, in 10 years prior to that, I'd been given record deals. I bought my own house. I bought my dream house. I lost that. All I left that house with was the mirror, because that was the only thing I used. And it wasn't to look in. You know, I took that mirror because it was the closest thing to me. I thought, oh, right, well, that's got to come with me. We need that, you know. What else are we going to chop up on, you know? And everything else I could get again. And that's been my philosophy. And it's the way I've always been, okay, I can destroy that. I can get something new. I don't need that. I can get something new. And you know what? There comes a point when there is nothing fucking new because you destroyed everything, you know, because you destroyed your soul, you destroyed everything. And, you know, at that point, you know, I was diagnosed HIV positive. You know, God knows how many people. I'll probably give it to the main person that was my partner. I destroyed other people's lives. You know, at that point in time, when I was diagnosed, I had 63 T-cells left, which, if any of you know, is anything below 200 is full-blown AIDS. And I had 63 left, and which was kind of like full-blown AIDS, I suppose. And I was dying. I was dying. And this still did not stop me from using. I was outside the hospital with a drip in my arm constantly. And I shared this yesterday, you know, outside, you know, having drugs delivered. It just, by the grace of God, I survived that. You know, I don't have it in my system today because I do something about it and I'm aware of it, like my addiction. I do something about it and I'm aware of it. You know, I kind of, you know, coming to this fellowship was the hardest thing I ever did. You know, it really was because, you know, giving up my life, because it was an amazing life, you know, was the hardest thing. You know, I had so much shit in my life, but it was my shit. It was comfortable. I was all right in it. So I thought, you know, every part of my body ached. You know, I stank. I had nowhere to live. I went to stay with my boyfriend for a week, 4.5 years later, putting all the hell that I put him through, you know. I could not go on any further, and I came to this fellowship, and this person said to me, oh, you know, come to this meeting. And I went to the meeting up in Duncan Terrace, and I always share this, you know. For me, it was like, I went in there, and there was like a cauldron in the middle of the room that people were like toasting their hands on. You know, it's like drip metal oil drum with fire in it, and they're like, and there was like dead pigeons flying around the room, and there was slime coming down the walls, and there was like a circle of tramps. Like, quite literally, a circle of tramps, and they were all like sitting there, yeah. And I thought, what the fuck is this? Yeah, and I remember looking around thinking, it was a Wednesday night. You never meet him. And, I love that meme. It was a Wednesday night, and I went, you know, and I remember just thinking, oh my God, this is not for me. I don't belong here. Look at them. One tooth. Look at them. Look at them all. Look, tramps. And I left, and the guy, you know, I'm not going to say who it was, Michael Pavey, he said to me, comes up to me at the end of the meeting and says, what do you think? And I was like, anyway, powerful, right? You fucking cunt. What the fuck is powerful about a load of tramps sitting in a circle around a fucking fire? Yeah, and off I trotted. You know, a year later, life was over, you know, couldn't do no more. It was suggested to me that I came back to these rooms, and my partner's, at that time, my partner's sister was in recovery, which kind of like, you know, paved the way. I went off to drug rehabilitation centres, and I went off to rehab. I went down to a place called Bournemouth, amazing place. And it's kind of, I was there for 6 months, and, you know, I came forward to London from there. And my life's changed ever since, you know. Have I hit rock bottom yet? It's 5 past 8. Basically, you know, I came back to London and did the programme, worked this programme to the best of my ability. I was fucking insane. For 5 years, I was insane. I insulted every person. A lot of people in this room I insulted. I terrorised, I abused. I was a dry drunk. I was quite literally a mess. You know, I got to step 3 and thought, oh, I'm ruling. I'm floating. I don't need to do no more. You know, I was secretary in Fifth Street for 3 years. 3 years I had that. What was that about? That was my recovery. That was the only bit of recovery in my insane head that I had. And, you know, I had a sponsor who was amazing to go shopping with. And that was where it lied, you know. He's a best friend now, and but you know what, going back to the primary illness, sex, it destroyed my life. It took everything. It took every last ounce of self-respect, every last ounce of hope, every last ounce of decency I had, because it was my secret. I held on to it. The drink and the drugs were the ones you could see. The sex was the one that I could see, and it was all I could see. And it was the one that I held on to. It was mine. And, you know, I did years of therapy, did so many things, and never once ever mentioned it. One day, I remember, I had this counsellor, and I was seeing her for 2 years. And on the last day, as I was leaving, I said, about sex. And she went, sit down. As I was leaving the door, she went, you need to come and see me again. I went, yeah, I rearranged an appointment. Like, fuck, did I go back there? You know, and for the last 6 years, 7 years, I was insane in recovery. I was clean, but, you know, I was completely insane. I lost everything again, absolutely everything. And where do you go when your partner, who whose life you destroyed in recovery, is in recovery, and you're in recovery? Which meetings do you go to? Where do you get honest? How the fuck do you get honest, with more the question? And then I changed sponsors. I got a really good sponsor. Sounds a bit like a bingo caller in Blackpool, but he's a good sponsor. saying no names. eyes down. So basically, you know, and I reworked the steps, you know. I'm reworking the steps, and, you know, doing that step 4 and that step 5, fucking amazing. The reality, to actually get real, finally, and to leave those masks and get rid of those masks and actually look at my part. Wow, amazing. And to talk about that stuff, amazing. All hell broke loose after the step 5, completely and utterly. You know, I was in a new relationship and cheated. Yeah, the old lying, cheating skank was back, and after doing the step five, thinking, yeah, it's, everything's going to change. Yeah, change for the worse, because, you know, it brought all that stuff to the surface. And, you know, the six and the seven, I lived that six and the seven, you know, because those character defects, oh, fucking hell, were rife. And I felt every one of them, every time I did it. You know, I'm really proud to say that I'm now 11 months into a monogamous relationship for the first time in my life. I've not cheated. I've had no inkling of cheating. I have freedom for the first time in my life, and I mean real freedom. It's sometimes a little bit overwhelming. Sometimes I don't know what I'm doing with myself. I kind of find myself doing crazy things. But you know what? I'm not cheating. I'm not acting out. I'm getting married. Fucking insane, you know what I mean? I'm getting married. I hated gay marriage. I think, oh, what do puffs want to get married for? What left my time? But you know what? I'm doing it. I'm not entirely happy with doing it, I must say. I kind of battle it. No, I'm not. I'll be honest with you, because you know what? Suddenly, as soon as I said yes, I thought, what the fuck? And you know, I'm arguing every day. I'm doing everything that I possibly can to test whether I want this and destroy this, because that's what I do. Any bit of goodness, I do that. And until my programme kicks in and that moment of clarity, and I think, what the fuck are you doing, Tony? You know, I had this theory years and years ago when I was a kid that the only way to wake yourself up is slapping your own fucking face. And that is the only way to wake yourself up. You know, whatever I do, it's that way. And, yeah... The last month has been probably a really bad time for me, you know. Two really good close friends have died from this illness. There's a lot of new drugs out there. You know, if you've been around a long time, you go back out. Someone like me wouldn't stand a chance. I'd be dead within a week. I work in the most drug-filled clubs in Europe. I go into these places. It's step one, walking through the door for me. Every weekend, sometimes it's like the Crimean War in the medic room. You know, there's like people lying around wrapped in tinfoil everywhere, you know, because they've taken too much G. You know, we're on the brink of a crystal meth epidemic in this country. It's going unnoticed because it's all professional people. It's, you know, people that... It's going on behind closed doors. At the moment, you know, it's all about gay sex parties. Jacking up's gone, guys. It's now called slamming. You know, it's now trendy to slam. You know, and this is what we're going through and we're facing. And kids are dying. People are dying. And, you know, it's not like anything you had before, you know, where you'd come off of methadone and off smack and have a detox and stuff like that. You don't with these drugs. You know, with G, there is no clock. You die. Kids, they are just taking 1.3 every hour on the hour. They don't take that. They die, and they have heart failure and die, and it's happening all the time. And you know, we need to be aware of that stuff. And this is the next wave of what's coming through. You know, and it's kind of like, it's insane. We're so fucking lucky, I tell you. But I go to work and people go, oh, isn't it boring for you? I just look at them and I go, yeah, right. It's really boring for me. Fucking hell, have a good look. It's like, you know, fucking hell, you know, today, you know, I'm on step nine. Yeah, and it's kind of, you know, a lot of amends that I've made in my life already, you know, through by changing the way I am, you know, yeah, it's an amazing feeling, it really is. You know, I lost my dog 2 weeks ago. I hadn't for 14 years, and it was the biggest part of my life. Because you know what? Throughout everything, him and the other dog, Taylor, were all I had in life. That's all I had. They were the only ones who understood me, the only ones that took my bullshit, the only ones that were there for me, regardless. It was unconditional love, and you know what? I've never felt that before in my life, and I get that all the time now when I look for it, because I don't have to look for it. I find it. It's in these rooms. It's around me, because I'm so used to taking things for granted and taking people for granted. And when you lose someone or something, and it really, really rocked my world. And, you know, it's incredible, you know. the night that he died, you know, a couple of weeks ago, he had a stroke. He was 14, right? Amazing staff. Yeah, I went out to work and I come back, I got a phone call, my partner's like, oh, Richie's done, you better come home. And I was like, oh, fuck off. You know, it'd be all right, he's fine. And I got home and he wasn't. And I went to bed and I, you know, I kept checking on him all night and I knew. And instead of being the usual typical Tony, I'll take him to the vets and get him patched up and get him loads of drugs. Because he was on tramadol for 2 years. You know what I mean? And I had to take him off that because, you know, the consequences of his using. you know, I'd come home and he'd be standing in the corner staring at the wall, like, gasping. You know, it's like, fuck you. It's like, having to... seriously, you know. And, you know, and that type of stuff, those behaviours rub off of you when you're watching TV. You know what I mean? Yeah, kind of like, you know, I prayed that I could do the right thing. And you know what, this is what this program's taught me. It's given me the tools to be able to do that. I have faith today. I have a life today. I have people whose life I've destroyed back in my life. And, you know, the person that I was talking about earlier is my best friend, he's my soulmate today because of this fellowship and this program. This program's given me so much. I could not put into words how much this program's given me. I'm alive today. I'm alive. And I mean, you know, and I really, truly have freedom. You know, I deal too many Mars bars here and there and whatever else. But you know what? I don't have that urge and that obsession to destroy everything that I own and everything that I am, and I can walk around today and say I'm a fucking proud member of NA, and I'm one of these people that don't hide under a stone. If you come to me, I'll tell you where I got fucking clean, and I'm proud of where I got clean. You know, I'm not a believer of, oh, tradition says you can't. Fuck off. Fuck off. At the end of the day, if you can change one person's life by telling them to come to this fellowship, I'm not about 12-step stuff. You know, I tell people come up to me at work all the time and say, how do you do this? Quite simple. I work a program. And, you know, they're gurning their faces off, and the last thing they want to hear about is a fucking program. You know, it's like, but you know what? I have God in my life. I have an amazing life. And it's all due to you lot, this fellowship, this program, and the fact that I believe. Thank you.